All right, should be a good show for you today. Our good friend Gareth Porter is going to be back on the show to tell us what he knows. Iran policy. Iran talks. Iran nuke technology. All that stuff. With Gareth Porter the Great today on the show. I'm writing up a blog entry for stress right now. That's my blog, the stress blog. It's at scotthorton.org/stress. If you want to hang out during the show, in the chat room during the show, that's scotthorton.org/chat. I'm signed in now. Hey, everybody. How's things? All right. So yeah, good old Gareth Porter. And then, you know, I got a couple of invites out. I don't know whether I'm going to hear back in time. Everybody's got the excuse that it's too cold and snowy wherever they are for them to get where they're supposed to be, where they could do things like radio interviews. I'm not saying that's what they're telling me. I'm just saying that's the excuse I'm granting them all, because apparently it's too damn cold and snowy everywhere. It got down to 20-something last night, again, here in Austin, with the hard freezes. What is this? We usually have, what, 2-3 a year? This is out of control now. And, of course, no snow. If it's going to be 20 degrees, it ought to be snowing, right? So then at least there's the winter wonderland and all of that. But no, it's just cold. Anyway, I don't mind so much. I just like snow. Anyway, that's all right. I don't need guests. I'm my own guest. Hey, Scott, what do you think is important to talk about? Well, I got a whole list of all kind of crap. How about this? I was just listening on the top of the hour news there. I didn't bother reading this story. I saw the headline, but I didn't bother reading about it because it's not really my beat. But I just heard there where the UN is recommending to the Vatican that the Catholic Church, which after all is a top-down organization, that they recommend to them that they implement a mandatory reporting procedure for cases of child rape. And what I thought was, you think? you mean like that ought to go ahead and make that the policy then? To go ahead and tattletale in instances of priests raping little children. Mm-hmm. Okay. Silly me. I sort of thought they already probably would have had an official policy like that, even if they don't follow it, right? But that would have just been my false assumption. I can just see the South Park, the Vatican Council in South Park. Rabble, 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 rabble. What the hell do you mean? Public authorities have jurisdiction over child rape crimes within the church. No way. Rabble, 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 rabble. And the thing about it, what's funny is, it's not about Catholicism necessarily or anything else. What it is it's about institutions, bureaucracies, and the way the economics of these things. You know, the Catholic Church is just a bureaucracy like any other, right? Like a government agency or a giant corporation. And there, or, you know, look at the FBI, for example. They will let hell rain down before they admit that they screwed up a thing. They will fail to thwart 5 major terrorist attacks in a row. Just because in order to do so, they would have to admit that they screwed up the last one. You know? It's the same kind of thing. You gotta figure, it's not like on South Park. Most of the Catholic Church hierarchy are not child rapists, right? What could keep someone who is not a child rapist from getting a child rapist in trouble, right? Oh, same thing for the football team up there at Penn State. Well, I did see him raping a kid in the shower, but I thought, geez, he's a great defensive coach. What? He's part of the institution. And so people are, I mean, that's like the textbook, that's the quintessential most heinous crime, right? Short of taking somebody's life, that's the worst thing that somebody could do to somebody. What does it take to get them to look the other way? A little bit of their own narrow interest, their share in the interest of the bureaucracy they represent. It's amazing, right? It's, you know, life is one great big sociology experiment. You know, what would it take to get you to cover up somebody raping a kid? I guess they'd have to give you a job and a uniform. I don't know. I don't mean you specifically. I mean everybody except you, right? It's like the Milgram experiment. You wouldn't torture somebody to death just because some clown told you to, but everybody else would. Well, I guess, you know, not everybody's cut out to join the Catholic Church as a priest or a cardinal or a bishop or anything anyway. But anyway, so I'm not picking on the Catholics. It's the same thing within Orthodox Judaism. Did you see the thing? Our old friend Christopher Ketchum, who everybody wondered, whatever happened to Christopher Ketchum? And then somebody wrote that on my Facebook page. Whatever happened to that great journalist, Christopher Ketchum? I said, I don't know. And then a week later, blam, there he is. He's got a story all about the child rape inside the Orthodox Jewish community in Brooklyn, New York. And how, you know, there's one great crusading rabbi trying to change it all. And, you know, again, just, you know, religion to me especially, I guess. It's just another institution. It's just another human bureaucracy. There's nothing transcendent or magical or even superior in morality about it at all. About any of the institutions. Even if they claim that's their only goal is teaching morality to others. There's no reason to think that they're not liable for, you know, the same things. You know, this is the story. Remember, what was that movie? I didn't interview the lady about it because I didn't really like it. It was so statist and military worshipy. But it was the documentary about rape in the military, in the U.S. military. And they talked about how, and they had some men who were, you know, brave enough to come forward and admit it had happened to them. And a lot of them. Men and women both. And okay, so there's not much, I guess, rape of children in the military because they're not in the military. Maybe out in the neighborhood. But in the military, how are people getting away with this? Other people are willing to help them get away with it. To at least implicitly help them get away with it. Why? For the good of the institution. It's a strange thing. I'm not saying I've completely thought this through or read a book about it or anything, but when it's... When I've known about, you know, the scandals of child rape in the Catholic Church my whole life, I've heard about that kind of thing, and I'm aware that it became a real topic of public discussion sometime in the early 2000s, right? Where finally now it wasn't like an alternative media thing to talk about. It became a very major media thing to talk about, and here we are now more than 10 years later since then, right? And then I just heard on the top of the hour news, one of the suggestions from the UN panel is that the Catholic Church consider adopting a mandatory reporting policy. Right? That's no different than the contract at the corporation where you work, right? If you see a rape, you know, in the stairwell, you better report it. Right? Or you're fired, dude. What? I don't know. It just seems strange to me that in February 2014, what, and I'm sorry because this probably sounds ridiculous to all of y'all, but I can't get over it. I still feel like I'm living before 2000, looking ahead somehow. Can't get out of that mindset. So this is the future to me, man. You know, I got that pre-9/11 mindset everybody used to rail so hard against all the time. So this is the future. Here we are, way in the future. And no, still, that's a recommendation for future consideration. Hey, they got a really nice new pope. Maybe someone ought to ask him, would you consider recommending to the cardinals a mandatory reporting policy? If you are not a child rapist in the church and you see someone raping a kid, you should call the cops on them. That would be the rule. Or you're fired and you don't get to be a priest or a bishop or a cardinal anymore. How about that? Ooh, teeth in it. Yeah, in the name of liberty, man. Those kids own themselves, you know. You can't do that. All right. I didn't mean to waste that whole first segment on that topic. Just seems strange. I was going to talk about the Dallas DA in that same segment, too. I guess that'll wait till after the break. Gareth Porter's coming up. Don't go away. Foreign policy news. Cop hatred. Scott Horton Show. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Now, I'll tell you the God's honest truth. I'm flat broke. But I'm donating $25 to William Norman Gregg right now. There's a guy who the libertarian movement cannot do without. He is good on the cops issues. All the cops issues. And I like Radley Balco, and I think... Well, I kind of don't like some things about him, but, you know, he's a good guy, and he's really, honestly, I'll give him the credit for doing more than anyone to really, well, I don't know how to put it, I guess change the minds of people with power, or at least, you know, make them listen, bring the discussion of the dangers, of the atrocities, of the militarization of law enforcement in America to the attention of the people who actually can do something about it. And that's good, but nobody can write better than Will. Nobody cares about the victims more than him. And stays at it the way he does. I just love it. And anyway, you know what? I don't know if those guys have a friendly competition going or what, but if they just have a writing contest, who can cover police abuse the best and the most, that'd be fine with me. Now, Balco is now at the Washington Post, which is huge. I mean, that is huge. That is like world historical huge, I think. American historical huge. That's going to make a difference. You know what? I think people are over it. I think time's coming when we're going to see state legislation banning the MRAP, banning armored personnel carriers, banning SWAT teams from any but the most dangerous missions. I don't know who I'm making air quotes for. There's no one in here but me. But anyway, well, as far as I know. Anyway. But Will Grigg, man. I love Will Grigg. He's a hell of a great writer on police state issues. Freedom in Our Time. .blogspot.com. He's not asking, he's insisting. Freedom in Our Time. .blogspot.com for his great blog, Pro Libertate. Or just search Will Grigg and help support what he does. That's what I just did. All right, and then, oh, that's interesting. Okay, so now, yeah, hey, man, so I'm driving around yesterday, and sometimes I like to listen to National Public Radio because it's funny to me what liberals think, really. It makes me laugh in a ha-ha kind of way. We're in a, man, you people are completely ridiculous kind of way most of the time. Anyway, and it's also, it's very state-biased, state-centric. Radio, so you got to know your enemy, right? I'm listening to NPR, and Audie Cornish is interviewing, I think it was her. No, you know what? Maybe it wasn't her. Anyway, one of them was interviewing the DA of Dallas County. And the DA of Dallas County, I'm sorry, I don't know his name, he's a black man. And I think she said he's the first black man ever to be elected the district attorney of a county in Texas. Well, so what's this guy's thing? He came in right away, set up a conviction integrity unit to go back through the convictions to basically, you know, proverbially, let's wipe our hands of all the previous administrations in this office. Nothing personal, but there is no continuity here. We don't care about making them look bad or any about their feelings or anything like that. It's not like there's any accountability for government employees who frame up or prosecute innocent people or anything like that. They don't have to worry, except maybe about being embarrassed. But damn their embarrassment. We're setting up a conviction integrity unit to go back through every case where they really swore they really didn't do it. But we got them anyway. And let's make sure. And they went back and they found, I believe he said right away, they found 33 instances of people doing prison time. And going quite a way back. Quite a ways back. 33 instances of people doing prison time who it was the wrong guy. And they admitted it, fessed up, let him out, maybe gave him $100,000 for, sorry, about 25 years of your life. They said in three of those cases, they turned around and found out who really did it and convicted them. But anyway, so one of the questions for him from the NPR interviewer, and I don't think this was so much playing devil's advocate as just, I mean, maybe she was playing it well, but it sounded like just her own question from her own understanding and point of view that, well, but wait a minute. I mean, your job is prosecuting people. It's the defense attorney's job to get them off. It's the appeals process's job to get them off. It's an adversarial thing. You're supposed to try your best, not pull punches and not, you know. Oh, because they were talking about all the measures that they had implemented to try to prevent this in the future. Like, we're going to no longer attempt to convict people based on the word only of a co-defendant. We're asking all the participating jurisdictions to come up with something else, because that's not going to be good enough. We don't want to take that into court, even if we can convince a jury. And then there were a few other reforms, making it, telling the cops and the other, you know, and the lower and the associated jurisdictions, we need a higher standard for even bringing these cases to trial. So then she says to him, well, but why would you do such a thing and undermine your own thing? That's not your role. You're undermining your own role, which is to win at these prosecutions. And he said, actually, that's not right. The job of a district attorney, according to the laws of the state of Texas, and then, you know, I'm paraphrasing him here, but he said that he was pretty sure the laws of every other state in this union are, that job is to seek justice. Not to win at trial. In other words, that ridiculous fantasy where the prosecutor on Perry Mason or on Matlock says to the judge, whoa, you got me. I moved to dismiss the charges. Wow, Matlock, you bested me again. I had no idea that your client actually really was innocent. But now that I know, boy, oh boy, I would have never tried to prosecute him. This Dallas County District Attorney is explaining to NPR, that's my job. My job is to, I mean, I'm putting words in his mouth. This is basically what he's saying, not his exact words. But basically what he's saying is, yeah, it's his job to be that prosecutor on Perry Mason. And it says, Your Honor, now that Perry Mason tricked the witness into admitting that he's really the bad guy, blam, I want nothing to do with hurting this guy anymore. I move to dismiss all charges with prejudice and set him go, da-da-da-da-da. I have no interest whatsoever in prosecuting somebody who didn't really do it. My mistake. And that's not how business is done in America. And that sure as hell is not how business has been done in Dallas County or any county I think that I could name in Austin, in Texas. Although, not that I know everything about all of them. And there are, you know, professionals in some of these offices in some cases. But I think the typical rule is, as I've told y'all on the show before, a Harris County, that's Houston, Texas, assistant DA told me, and there's no way she was making this up or whatever, this was their slogan. If they really didn't do it, they'll get out on appeal. And what that means is that a prosecutor is the orders from on high in the DA's office are prosecute to the nth degree anyone the cops bring you. Your job is not justice. Your job is winning. And if they really didn't do it, they'll get out on appeal. Now, what's the evidence for that? Nobody knows. Of course, when you appeal, if you're wrongfully convicted, and or rightfully, whatever, convicted, and you're in prison, first of all, to appeal, now the burden of proof is on you. It's supposed to be beyond a reasonable doubt burden on the state to prove that you did what they claim you did. Now the burden is on you, like in a civil case, the way they calculate it, I think it's not even 51%. They try to quantify the quality and say the burden is on you 2/3, whatever that means. And not to prove that you're not really the guy, but to prove that the prosecutors broke the rules, that the judge screwed up, that your trial process was unfair. And if you can prove that, then maybe you have a shot at a new trial. Now, so then that means if you have severe evidence, it would have to be good to win in the trial motions and the hearings and whatever, that the prosecuting attorneys deliberately withheld evidence, Brady material that could have helped acquit you from your defense attorney or something like that, then you can get a new trial. But there is no appeal that based on, I swear I didn't do it. You got the wrong guy. Please look at the evidence again. I think that you won't be quite satisfied of the verdict anymore. There is no appeal like that. And so if they quote unquote rightfully in the process can wrongfully convicted an innocent person, that's still all right. In fact, there was a thing here in Texas. And you know, I tried to find this. I Googled the hell out of this one time. I couldn't find it again, but it was a court decision. I bet it's out there. Maybe you can find it, chat room guys. It was a court decision from, I believe, here in Texas about the innocence of someone who was locked up, where the court decided that the state's interest in the people's respect for the finality of the court's decisions outweigh pursuing this any further. Did you get that? If we admit that what we're doing here is so screwed up that we got even this wrong, well, that could undermine the people's belief in our right to be their overlords and decide these things for them, like which of them should be locked in cages like animals. And we cannot have that. And so that interest outweighs the right of a convicted person in a cage. The finality of the court must be respected. Take that. Well, there's one good DA in America, the DA of Dallas County. We'll see how long he lasts. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And now to Ukraine. The top U.S. diplomat for Europe. Quote, F the EU. Only she didn't say F because she's even less polite than me, if you could imagine that. So that's at BuzzFeed.com, and what happened was a phone call was leaked. that appears to expose a conversation between a top U.S. State Department official and the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Updated with comments from Jay Carney, it says here at BuzzFeed.com. Rosie Gray here. So now here's the thing of it. I guess I'm trying to see if they confirm. I guess they still haven't confirmed. But they didn't deny it. Apparently, perhaps, maybe, it seems like must have been the Russians tapped the call and then leaked it. And so what's the call? Now, the headline is, uh-oh, somebody said a bad word, and I'm telling on you so that you get in a lot of trouble. But what it's really about is that the leader of the Ukraine, who has been under all this Western pressure from the U.S. and the EU to sign this new trade deal with the EU and move further toward the West, said he was going to and then changed his mind under pressure from Vladimir Putin and decided he was going to tilt back toward the Russians after all. And so the Americans and the pro-Western factions inside Ukraine, and the country's very split, politically speaking, they have been keeping the pressure on, basically trying to overthrow the government with the massive protests out front and all that. Now, if you check out any Western media about this, all you'll see is the people out in the street trying to overthrow the government. But yeah, it's an elected government because they won the election. So yeah, the people protesting against them aren't everybody. They're just somebody's. And anyway, so luckily it's not quite a civil war, although a cop has been killed and a couple of protesters have been killed, I believe. But the president of Ukraine has tried to compromise, and I'm not saying it's enough or whatever. It's none of my business, and I don't know that much about it. But he tried to offer the prime minister position to a guy from the opposition. And in fact, the deputy prime minister position as well. So then this phone call is the U.S. diplomat to the European Union on the phone with the U.S. diplomat to the Ukraine talking about how the EU wants this guy. Basically, they're the ones, I guess, who had suggested to the president that a good compromise would be to make A, the prime minister, and B, the deputy prime minister. But the Americans don't like that. They don't like the guy chosen by the EU for prime minister. They like the guy that's been chosen for deputy, and he ought to be the one first, and the other guy should have to wait because he's not good enough for whatever their reasons are, and blah, blah, blah. You can go listen to the whole thing if you want. I don't think there's much doubt that it's genuine. Victoria Nuland and Jeff Pyatt are the two on the phone. And so anyway, the point is that the exclamation F the EU comes in the context of their discussion about the EU picked the wrong guy that they don't want to be the one of the opposition guys who's allowed in to the Russia leaning government there. And so the only thing that I care about that I, you know, would bring to your attention to care about here, you know, maybe to notice would be that Ukraine is not part of the United States. And in fact, it's none of the national government of the United States business who wins what election in any state in the Union either. Their only mandate on that issue is that they have the authority to guarantee a Republican form of government, meaning typically a bicameral Congress, but not necessarily. You could have a state assembly, you know, whatever. But still, you better have an independent judiciary and a governor and a secretary of state and an attorney general and all of this and that form of a republic. And it doesn't say what they can do about it if, you know, Washington State goes red or something like that, but anyway, they sure as hell have no mandate in the Constitution to pick and choose who are the leaders who should be the leaders of the country of Ukraine. You even know where Ukraine is? It's where my wife's from. I know where it is, but only because I've been interested in the region and that kind of thing. I think a lot of people don't know where it is, even. You might or might not be horrified to know that there's a gigantic lobby which would like to bring Ukraine into NATO, which is, you know, America's world army, basically, but it's the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So you might ask what the hell that has to do with Turkey, but man, look at Ukraine. That ain't the North Atlantic. Any more than West Texas is the North Atlantic. Although, you know, West Texas is part of a nation state that does border the Atlantic Ocean and everything, but I just mean, yeah, distance. It's the furthest thing from it. It's the furthest thing from our interests. And you know what? If Vladimir Putin literally held a gun to the guy's head and said, no, you're doing a trade deal with me, it's still none of the business of anybody in America about that at all. I mean, if you want to sign up and go fight as an individual in some civil war over there, be my guest. But does anybody ever stop to ask how in the world the Americans, and I mean the ones in D.C. running this thing, convince themselves that there's just no limit to what's up to them to decide who should be the prime minister, the deputy prime minister of Ukraine in any circumstance? And think of it this way. Look at all the Eastern European countries that have been brought into the NATO alliance. Well, what would happen if some real mean, you know, I don't know, Vladimir Putin's son one day rises up and invades Eastern Europe and conquers it and tries to recreate the Warsaw Pact? What are we going to do? We're going to get into a nuclear war? It used to be the line was West Germany. Now the line is Poland. If the Russians ever invade Poland again, we're willing to give up every city in America and every life within them? I think probably not. I think whoever would be the president, assuming it wasn't John McCain, would say, ah, hell, we just wanted to, you know, Poland's NATO membership was nothing but a welfare program for Lockheed. We never meant that we would really get into a nuclear war over Poland. You know, it's never a good idea to give a war guarantee to Poland, I don't think. I like to believe, and I think really, you know, the typical Republican or Democrat, if the Russians ever really did try to take back, quote unquote, Eastern Europe, I think the Americans would say, ah, that's too bad. Maybe we have another Cold War. Give a big Iron Curtain speech. But, well, if it was you, would you be willing to give up your hometown? You know, its entire existence. A-bombs and H-bombs going off in your home state. Would you be willing to tolerate that over the fate of Eastern Europe? See, I think, no. I think a lot of all this imperialism is a lot of play acting. It's just like with the Navy. You realize that the Navy has no real defense from a ballistic missile, that is, one falling on their head. And their defense from supersonic sea-skimming, you know, lateral missiles coming at them is just a Gatling gun and an Aegis radar. Good luck. Cross your fingers. But, you know, as the war nerd says, why do you think they don't keep nuclear weapons on aircraft carriers? Because they know that they're just for show. They're sitting ducks. They're World War II technology. Obsolete. The whole thing is really all just, again, collecting welfare checks for people to build giant floating fortresses to sink into the sea and replace. Keep that money away from people where they might better be able to spend it on themselves, improving their own lives. You know, like in George Orwell. But yeah, anyway, so There you go, meddling in Ukraine, and I don't know the extent of it. I don't know if anybody's done really solid reporting on the extent of it. If anybody knows of any solid reporting like that, please let me know. But you can bet that the CIA and USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy and all those guys are bankrolling revolution in Ukraine right now. It's a replay. It's an attempted replay of the coup d'etat of 2004, the bogus Orange Revolution. Well, let's not say it's completely bogus, but yeah, to the degree to which it's funded and, you know, helped along and controlled from the outside, that's the degree to which it's phony. You know, again, there is a real big political split in Ukraine between the Orthodox and the Catholic, between the Western leaning and the Eastern leaning. And that kind of thing in politics, and who knows what other major issues and interest groups and what, but here's another hypothetical for you. I'm plagiarizing Pat Buchanan now. Hey, what if Red China, what if capitalist China invaded and conquered Mongolia? What are you gonna do about that? Or what if they invaded Turkmenistan or Tajikistan or something over there? Which one's closer? I forget. Kyrgyzstan. You gonna get into a nuclear war with China over aggression in Kyrgyzstan? Or you're just gonna say, yeah, I don't care. Sorry, Kyrgyz, you know. Too bad for you. That would be my policy, the too bad for you policy. Think I'm giving up Austin, Texas, and Los Angeles, and Denver, and Seattle for any part of Turkmenistan or Kyrgyzstan? You're crazy. Right? So, anyway, U.S. out of Ukraine. And good luck to the Ukrainians. I got family from there. Married into a family from there. So I'm not saying it's unimportant. I'm just saying there's nothing I can do about it. And so, therefore, it's none of my business. I mean, it is my business to think about, but not to do stuff about. And yeah. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. Hey, all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, y'all, welcome back. So Eli Lake has a piece out today in the Daily Beast, worthy of note. And he's a really lousy reporter, and best I can tell from his Twitter feed, a really lousy individual. He's helped lie you into numerous conflicts in the past. I don't know if anybody's got the full dossier on him. But anyway, this piece... Well, it confirmed my bias, so it must have been good. What it says is there's no indication that Edward Snowden has worked with any intelligence agency or that they've gotten anything out of him. There's a lot of quotes from a lot of U.S. government employees on and mostly off the record. You know, their names, that is. Saying, oh, he must have given over everything to the Russians. Oh, you must think the Russians are little bitty babies if you don't think that they must have gotten a hold of all of his stuff and this and that. But then he does a really good job of cataloging all the reasons to believe that that's just not true, including the fact that one of his jobs at the National Security Agency, or as a contractor for them, was teaching military intelligence people how to keep their electronic secrets even in very, high-stress situations, i.e., for example, China. That was his speciality, one of them. And he also talks about how all this ridiculous stuff where, you know, and Greenwald keeps disputing this. Greenwald says, I got about 20,000 documents, something like that. And then they go, oh, 58,000 documents. Oh, a million billion documents. Olympia Snow, he quotes Senator Snow. Is she still a senator? I thought she was gone away. I think it's Olympia Snow, he quotes, saying, oh, it's a stack of documents 3 miles high. Shut up. You don't know anything. That's why you say such stupid things, you stupid idiot. Accidental liar, right? There she is, parroting lies of others, as though she knows what she's talking about. That's one big reason to not believe the government. Because then you look like a real jackass every time you repeat what they claim as though it's a fact. Oh, 3 miles high worth of stacked papers he leaked, huh? Yeah, yeah, yeah. But as Eli Lake explains, well, that's based on the idea that every time he ever looked at any one or zero or had access to any one or zero anywhere on the NSA servers, that he must have scanned and copied and downloaded and stolen, liberated, all of it. But that's only a stupid assumption. There's no evidence of that, and actually, there's no reason to believe that. Now, I understand how if you are a forensic investigator working for military intelligence or the FBI, you have to assume the worst and work from there, okay? But it's pretty obvious from here that, no, he stole whatever. He took the documents that needed taking. That the people needed to see. And the stuff that he took that was beyond what he wanted the public to see, Greenwald and Snowden themselves have explained, were just for the journalists themselves. So they would be able, he was basically letting them in on the classified program, but telling them, use your utmost discretion, and some people don't agree with this, on the release all the documents immediately side, you know. But he said, use your discretion and only publish stuff that is legitimate. People need to know, have the right to know, whistleblowing stuff where the government is going over the line. Or at least, you know, or is really close to it. And the people ought to be able to decide what's over the line or not and this kind of thing. And then, so any documents beyond what was meant to be released were given to Greenwald, Poitras, Gelman, just so that they and, you know, whatever expert collaborators they could bring on board to work with them on the journalism would have a real understanding of what it was they were looking at and where it fit in context with what the NSA was doing. So they would have the understanding. But he and Greenwald says repeatedly when people criticize him and say, dude, just release all the documents. Just post all the documents. Enough of this drip, drip, drip. For, you know, what, years or months or what? How long is this going to go on? Just leak them. He says, look, you know, I might, or even if I wanted to, I can't. Because I promised Ed Snowden I wouldn't. That was part of the deal. Was that I would only release the stuff as I was reporting it. And I can only report it as fast as I can get the paragraphs all written and make sure that they're all right and that it tells you everything, the whole truth, what you need to know in it. Only then can I hit publish on it. And so, man, I'm sorry, you gotta wait. Because I promised Ed Snowden. That was the deal. In other words, there's strong indication that he only took what he wanted Greenwald to publish and what he thought Greenwald needed to know beyond that to be able to publish accurately and explain in context what it was that what the documents we're looking at say and what they mean and how they relate to other things that we already know or what we don't, etc. Same thing goes for Barton Gellman at the Washington Post. Barton Gellman at the Washington Post, who wrote the biography of Dick Cheney. And I'm not saying it's a hagiography like, you know, some David Frum piece of crap. It's a pretty critical biography, I guess. But it's the Washington Post biography of Cheney, Engler. And he's done some great work. I'm not really knocking him, but he's a very mainstream kind of guy with mainstream sensibilities and mainstream reporting techniques and a very mainstream voice in his journalism and whatever. So Greenwald, you know, likes to stick up for his source and kind of stand out. And Gellman is more of a mainstream kind of a personality. They're both doing the exact same thing. They're both up to the very same business here. And anyway, so you know, Gellman is abiding by the same standard. He has all the documents too, and you know, he only gives negative indications. He doesn't believe that any of this is right. And I've heard him interrupt interviewers before to say, listen, I'm only a reporter. I'm not telling you my opinion. I can report to you that there is no evidence that Edward Snowden ever gave any of this stuff to anybody but journalists. That's it. And all the rest of this is all just a bunch of smoke. And in fact, when it comes to the amount of what he must have taken, it's all just a bunch of smoke. There's no reason to believe it's true at all. In fact, like I was explaining yesterday, it's really not that these amount to, you know, kind of just, you know, claims and not even arguments at all. There's not even a real argument there because it's not meant to convince anybody who wants evidence or a real argument. It's meant to convince people who are already tailor-made, ready to be fooled and want to be fooled and want to cheer along with, you know, Rush Limbaugh or whoever, you know, Mike Rogers, whatever right-wing personality they've ceded their opinion to on this one, and, you know, be convinced. Cheer for the team that's already winning, the state, so it makes them feel good. But there's Eli Lake, and listen, man, you know, I started off talking bad about the guy personally and this and that. I shouldn't have. What I really should have said about him, which is true, is that here's a guy who is very, very willing to give the government's point of view a fair hearing. Okay? That is understating it quite a bit. But here's a guy who his sources talk to him because he's pretty reliable at putting out the view that the government wants out there. He has very high-level sources, and they're not usually, you know, not that I have everything he ever wrote in a list in front of me or anything, but it's not usually of a whistleblower nature. I would have expected him to be much harder on Snowden in this article. I think he frankly just had to admit that, man, I really don't have anything on the guy. In fact, I'll have you look at it. It's good. I mean, he talks about the CIA or the DIA assessment and all this stuff. Snowden keeps outwitting U.S. spies, it says. Well, and that's about how, well, he may or may not have this stuff and have hidden it somewhere, but the article doesn't really read like that. The article really reads more like, nah, he doesn't have it. As he's already said, even if the Russians torture me, I couldn't give it to them because I don't have it with me and I don't even know the codes. He's already given it up. And again, I'm sorry this is redundant, but I'm going to go ahead and bring it up again because I'm almost out of time and, you know, I might as well finish out this subject and stick to Snowden. And I think this is so important. This whole smear about, oh, Snowden's in Russia needs to be, may I enlist your help? Needs to be redirected at the President of the United States, Barack Obama. It was Obama who left Snowden stranded in Russia. If he ever tells the Russian government anything about the NSA's or the CIA or anything he learned while he was there about what they're doing or how they do it. It is all Barack Obama's fault. Who the hell is his national security advisor right now? Who the hell is his secretary of defense? How are they not resigning over this? Give the man back his passport right now. Let him go to Latin America. You could nab him easier there. He's going to be pretty hard to murder in Moscow. Anyway, you know, all this smearing of Snowden based on the fact of his geography, it was Barack Stalin who exiled him to Siberia. He did not choose to go to Russia himself. All right. Gareth Porter coming up and news. Scott Horton Show, scotthorton.org. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. All right, here, a couple things more real quick here on Snowden and the NSA and this and that. Glenn Greenwald, it says at Salon.com that he says he's coming back to the U.S. He wants to force the issue. He's waiting till he has a reason to come back, like to see his family. Or he says what? Seeing his family is not a reason to come back, I think he says. That's weird. But he says, well, if he has a reason to come back, he wants to come back. And now that he thinks about it, forcing the issue and picking the fight with the Department of Justice would be the best reason to do so. Or a strong reason to do so. I say no. I say finish the work. Report the stories, then come home and let them prosecute you for espionage, and then whoop them. But your time in jail without bail, awaiting trial, where you might not win, because I've read the Espionage Act, it's pretty broadly written, that'll be time spent not publishing stories based on these documents. So I totally understand where Glenn Greenwald is coming from on freedom of speech here, and I would like to see him win that fight, represent himself or whatever he's got to do, and go in there and kick the hell out of the Department of Justice and the courts if that's possible, but not yet. You know what I mean? I don't want to see Glenn Greenwald go to prison. I don't want to see a stop to his reporting either. First things first. First things first. But it is amazing. I mean, here they prosecuted Edward, or they've indicted Edward Snowden, or they've charged him, or whatever step they're on, I forget. But anyway, they want to put him in prison on espionage charges. Even though, again, no, he's just a whistleblower, and there's no evidence whatsoever that, and there's no reason to believe, there's no indication that he did this to advance the interests of any foreign power whatsoever. The whole thing is stupid. So there's that, and they charge him with espionage. Well, that's the same law. Thanks again, Woodrow Wilson, for everything. The same law that they could try to use against Glenn Greenwald. After all, it's only tradition so far that they don't prosecute reporters, that they don't try, the feds, I mean, to prosecute reporters for publishing information based on classified documents, or for publishing classified documents. They will beg and plead and exert a hell of a lot of influence outside the law in order to prevent stories from being published. But they don't just go around prosecuting reporters for publishing secrets. For example, When Daniel Ellsberg was spoken to 100 times, when Daniel Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers, they prosecuted him. They didn't prosecute the New York Times. I guess they threatened to regulate him or whatever, and and got a lower court to put an injunction on them forbidding them from publishing them. But then the Supreme Court took the side of the paper and said there can be no prior restraint. But in fact, in that decision, they kind of left the door open. That maybe if they do reveal something that you really, really, really wish they hadn't, that maybe you could prosecute them for that. There can be no prior restraint. I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying I'm pretty sure it's right that that's what the court said. So anyway, but it ought to be just absolute knee-jerk, hell no reaction on the part of every American of every ideological description, no matter what politics you've got about anything. If you don't have a free press, you don't have any rights at all. You got nothing, because you have no chance of knowing the truth enough to know what to even start coming up with an idea about what to do about it. That's the big problem of the secrecy of the national security state in the first place. That's why it took Edward Snowden to do this. And here is Sensenbrenner, Jim Sensenbrenner, who is the, they say he's the author of the Patriot Act. The Department of Justice are the authors of the Patriot Act. But anyway, I guess he is one of the major sponsors of it in the House of Representatives, Jim Sensenbrenner. He says, you're crazy if you're going to argue that Section 215 allows bulk collection. Quote, no fair reading of the text would allow for this program. In other words, the Patriot Act did not legalize the behavior that the NSA is engaged in and is invoking the Patriot Act as their justification for. They're violating the law. It'd be like if I printed my own currency and said the Federal Reserve Act says I can. No, they're talking about somebody else, not you, Scott Horton, would be the answer. Off to prison I go. So anyway, if only I could counterfeit. Man, that'd be great. So anyway, that's why Edward Snowden had to do what he did, was because they're breaking the law. And they're lying about it. And that's what Edward Snowden says in the interview with German TV, is they ask him, the reporter, individual reporter asks him, so was there a point where you decided that you had to do this? Like, now's the time you're going to do this? And he said it was when Clapper testified and was asked by Senator Ron Wyden whether they're collecting data on Americans, and he perjured himself and said no. And that was just an outright lie. And he could tell, I guess, you know, from there, he knew that Wyden knew better, but Wyden wouldn't say it. And that was it. And so if there's no oversight, then there is. You hear all the slogans, the talking points about how, oh, this is all verified by all the different branches of government. Yeah, secret court. Once they let an actual federal court get a hold of it, the first judge said, are you kidding me? And ruled against it. And then, of course, the oversight in the Congress is rendered a complete joke. Anyway, so I spaced out and didn't finish that point right, I think. I don't remember. One more thing about domestic police state stuff today. I saw there's a hearing. It's actually going on right now. IRS targeting of conservative groups. And now, so the Tea Party types are going, oh my God, the Democrats are persecuting us. And the liberals are saying, nah, that's a lie, because they are persecuting a bunch of left-wing groups too. Well, wait a minute. How come it can't be true that they're persecuting both? Hey, Tea Party guy, you acknowledge, for some reason, their feelings depend on it, okay? So you go ahead and acknowledge that, yeah, they IRS the hell out of a bunch of left-wing Occupy type groups too. And that maybe that's problematic too. And then maybe the liberals will be able to get over their little feelings enough to concede that, yeah, the IRS is targeting political groups on the right and the left. And what was it that these groups had in common, if anything at all? Do they have anything in common, these groups, some on the left and some on the right, some on the Tea Party, some on the Occupy? Yeah, they're outside of the actual power structure of the political class and the corporate state. They're regular Americans, stupid enough to believe that this is a democracy, a republic, that they have the right to participate in any way. And so they're trying to. And that's not a lot. Especially if they're going to go, you know, around the parties and just protest outside, give themselves new names. People so caught up hating each other, they don't realize that their common enemy is the state. And especially, isn't that funny when you would think that's why they form these groups outside of the typical party structure in the first place? But then to hear the right-wingers tell it, only right-wingers were targeted by them damn left-wingers. I don't know. I think it's absolutely horrible anytime the IRS audits anyone ever for any reason, other than maybe if you're talking about government employees and government contractors cashing government checks, and the IRS wants to clamp down on that. But on any, let's say taxpayer instead of tax eater, I'm against any audit. What kind of terrorism is that, auditing somebody? What gives the government the right to somebody else's money? Nothing. And of course, persecuting political groups is all about fear. It's not just about the people being persecuted. It's about making people hesitant to want to participate themselves. You know, man, I heard that if you just donate to the local Democrats, that's an automatic investigation. Whoa, I think I won't. Or vice versa. Fill in the blank. If I donate to the Greens or to the Libertarians, what might the NSA flag on my account? Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm here because I'm an anti-imperialist. And so here's where I complain about imperialism. All right, so I got to go fast because I got to talk about Iraq, Syria, and Palestine all in one segment here before Gareth Porter time. So first, Iraq. U.S. steps up military support for Iraq. State Department. Al-Qaeda in Iraq is an army. Iraq continues to engage in an open-ended bloody conflict with Al-Qaeda in Iraq, attacking Al-Qaeda targets in Anbar province, where their bombs tear through the rest of Iraq. It's a horrible mess. So naturally, the U.S. wants in on it. That's Jason Ditz at antiwar.com, news.antiwar.com. State Department official Brett McKirk testified at the House Foreign Affairs Committee on Iraq, declaring AQI, quote, is an army, and that the U.S. needs to give Iraq security support to contend with them. Yeah, they were all for it. Of course, sending military forces to insinuate themselves into Iraq's new war under any name is just a stepping stone toward a new U.S. intervention in the country. And any boots on the ground in a combat situation will eventually become combat troops. Oh, because they're sending in trainers. They want to send advisors and trainers. That was the part I skipped there, sorry. And they're going to sell them a ton of weapons. So, there you go again. Still backing the Maliki government, the United Iraqi Alliance of the Shiite Arabs, or at least those among the Shiite Arabs who lord it over the rest of them. I'm not trying to imply they have some great mandate for power or anything, the ones in power, any more than you and I choose who runs this country. But anyway, so U.S. steps up support for the Maliki government in their fight against anyone who opposes them in the Anbar province. Yes, there are Al-Qaeda attacks all over the country, but it's the tribal leaders that are really at loggerheads with Maliki, and he's done it to himself. Although I think that may have been his strategy, is he can pick a fight with the Anbar province tribal leaders all he wants. It makes him look better, or at least makes him look necessary to the Shiites, that they need a strong leader to protect them from these terrible enemies. And he doesn't really have the power to conquer the Anbar province anyway, and to really, you know, lord it over them and really be the government of the Sunni Arab parts of Iraq. And so forget it. We'll just go ahead and make them the permanent terrorist enemy. George Bush gave the Shiites Baghdad, so that'll have to be good enough. Forget Tikrit and Fallujah. They can bomb the hell out of them, but they're never going to really, I don't think ever really going to take over. And then, so anyway, I just think this is, you know, I don't know if the people in the State Department, Defense Department even talk about this kind of stuff. Do they just pretend that they don't notice what I notice when I read these headlines in a row? U.S. steps up military support for Iraq, and U.S. tells Iraq you're not doing enough to stop Iran from flying cargo planes to Syria. My God, man. It really is. Like Phil Grinsoli, I'm sorry I said your name wrong. It's like Corky always says, man. It's the Three Stooges running American foreign policy over here. Iraq and Syria, there's just a phony British and French drawn line between them there. We're backing the Iranians and the Shiite Arabs in Iraq against the Sunni Arabs and Al-Qaeda. But on the other side of the line, we're backing the Sunni Arab insurgency led by Al-Qaeda. The three different Al-Qaedas, Al-Nusra, ISIS, and the new so-called Islamic Front, which is still the same damn thing. And the guy says, yeah, I used to know bin Laden and everything, the leader of the new Islamic Front. So, yeah. OG Al-Qaeda guy running that thing. But in Syria, we're on the side of the Al-Qaeda suicide bomber, prisoner beheaders, against the Shiite Arab parties, the Baathists, and their government of Syria. This is on the same day. You got the State Department complaining this and complaining that. How in the world is this not the biggest deal in the world? Syria rebels. U.S. increased aid after the Geneva talks failed. Rebels launch U.S.-funded South Syria offensive. Right? Okay. It's just you, Scott. Everybody else gets it. What's your problem? Is that the thing? Is it me? I'm not trying to be some kind of ethnic collectivist here and group people into categories where they don't belong or anything. I'm pretty sure that these people are belonging in the categories in which I'm assigning them here. I mean, I know I'm being relatively broad, but we're talking about battles. We're talking about wars on the ground and who is fighting for who. This is completely crazy. As crazy as it was to have our allies, the Saudis, financing the Sunni-based and Al-Qaeda insurgency against the occupation in Iraq, as we're fighting for the Iranians the whole time. You can't tell me Obama's not dumber than Bush, or as dumb. Or at least, I'm starting to take his word for it that maybe he's not really the president of anything after all. More and more he gets caught talking about, well, you know, the government, I guess I'll ask them, see what they want to do. Yeah, that sounds about right, you know. And then, by the way, in parentheses here, despite all the hype over the last week, the Syrian disarmament plans are still in place. They've been getting rid of all their chemical weapons, and they've given up the locations of all of them, and they're up to date on all their deadlines, and it's all just a bunch of crap. It'll all be done on schedule, according to the international guys, right? Not the British politicians and the others making the claims, but the actual OPCW there in charge of it said, oh yeah, no, we're working, we'll be finished by the end of the month. So enough of your hype on that one. It really is amazing the sides America's picking in the Iraq and Syrian wars here and how they get away with it. And I'll tell you how they get away with it. Here's how they get away with it. They never told you the truth about the Iraq war in the first place. All they ever said was, can't cut and run. Can't stop now. Can't let all the guys who died on the mission die in vain. They never said what they were doing, who they were backing, and why, and what it was resulting in. And they never, you know, threw up a color-coded map of the region and said, this, that, and the other thing. Get it? They never did that. Not on TV, and really not in the papers. I mean, you had to read the great reporters or listen to this show. Read antiwar.com on a regular basis, where they're hunting down these stories from around the world to explain who the hell is Muqtada al-Sadr anyway. Maybe bad guy fits. If people, you know, if you show people a picture of him and they recognize him at all, bad guy. Maybe Iraqi bad guy. They know anything about what it means that he's a powerful person, how it was that it became that way. And why they ought to care at all. And so here we move into the war next door, where the policy is the exact opposite, and at the same time that the old Iraq policy continues, and nobody even notices the contradiction. It's not even a scandal. It's not even a controversy. Oh, just, you know, sprinkle in a little obfuscation about backing the moderates and not the extremists. Give me a break. It's amazing. It's amazing. That's half the fun of this job. It still is a shock to my senses or whatever. Something about the weirdness of what media gets away with having people believe. You know? What the government gets away with having the media have people believe. How do they do it? How do they get away with blue bloody murder? In the most literal sense. Huh? It's incredible. I mean, it's not like you can't get a hold of Patrick Coburn. Hey, NBC, call me. I'll give you Patrick Coburn's email address. You can interview him on the Brian Williams show tonight. Yeah, right. All right, and now real quick, what time is it? Oh, good. I still got a couple of minutes. Rabbis to Kerry. That's the Secretary of State, and that's the Israeli rabbis. Some of them. Cease mediation or face divine retribution. Rabbis calling themselves the Committee to Save the Land and People of Israel. Write the U.S. Secretary of State warning that his actions were a declaration of war against the creator and ruler of the universe. Whoa, John Kerry, you better back down then. A group of rabbis warned Secretary of State John Kerry to cease his pursuit of the peace process between Israel and Palestine or face divine retribution in a letter sent by them Sunday. And then here is, by the way, just I should have this one should have gone first on the list. Israel announces 558 more settlement permits in East Jerusalem, just to make it clear how little interested they are in any kind of John Kerry peace plan or any other one. Either. And so then here's they're denouncing Kerry. Mad smack being talked about America and the American Secretary of State in Israel over the past few weeks. I think I mentioned on the show that Susan Rice even outright said, this is unacceptable, you better apologize, and that kind of thing. One of them did, for talking about, you know, questioning Kerry's sanity and that kind of thing. But then here is Naftali Bennett, and he is, I believe, I'm not sure if he's a religious guy. I think he's not. I think he's one of the secular right-wing nationalists like Avigdor Lieberman. I could be wrong about that, but he's some kind of right-wing nationalist anyway. Israel, our home. No. It's a different party. But anyway, he's calling Kerry's plan to put NATO in the Jordan Valley crazy, and I think he's right. I think I don't think that God's going to be mad at them, but I think that these guys still think that God gave this land to them, and they're not giving up the West Bank, and putting NATO between them and their enemies is a mistake. Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy, only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. I'm on Liberty Express Radio. And hey, check it out. Gareth Porter wrote a thing. So I got to interview him about it. So I want to. Hey, Gareth, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me again. Once again, Scott.
Happy to have you on here. And I see that you've written a thingamajig here. Going back in history, a little bit of context. And I assume this must be in your book, which I still haven't gotten. What an important story. How it is, I mean, I have to admit I'm surprised. I mean, the bottom line of your story, I think, is that you're saying that the Americans have, in a sense, only have been accidentally lying about Iran's nuclear program, at least in the window of time between, say, early 1990s, somewhere in there, and 07?
Well, I think I would somewhat modify that by saying, I mean, you're on the right track, but I would say that the statement about the U.S. Conclusion that Iran was trying to get nuclear weapons, that had a nuclear weapons program, is really about from the early 1990s up to the Bush administration taking office. Then, I mean, I think the intelligence community still relies on the same basic analysis, but then you have other. There are other political interests entering in, even in the Clinton administration from the White House. So all I'm talking about here, excuse me, all I'm talking about is the intelligence community's finding, as opposed to the policy positions taken by either the Clinton administration or the Bush administration.
Right, as George Bush said to the Israelis, well, you know, the CIA has their opinion and I have mine, but unfortunately, I'm bound by theirs.
The findings of the intelligence community has never prevented the administration from being able to do what it really wanted to do, I think I would argue. So I think you're correct in that general statement.
Yeah. All right. So now, take us back then to the earlier 90s when the Iranians were up to something and the CIA, lo and behold, got it wrong. How'd they get it wrong? What happened?
This is, I think, one of the important stories that I tell in the book. So you are correct that this is drawn from manufactured crisis.
Wait a minute. Let me interrupt you for a sec longer here because I got to tell the people that this is still, as of right now, hopefully no other further crises break out today. This is the top headline today at antiwar.com. Errors led analysts to see Iran nuke program. That's nuke weapon program there.
All right. Thank you for telling us that. So this is one of the stories that is told in the book, and it's a very important one, as you've already suggested in your introduction, about the origins of the U.S. intelligence conclusion that Iran was not just sort of interested in nuclear weapons, but was actually taking actions that could only be interpreted, or which they definitely interpreted, as being involving an actual program, as they put it later on, they being the head of the CIA put it, to produce the fissile material for a nuclear weapon. And so what the story shows is that it all began when Western intelligence agencies began to intercept telexes that were being were coming from the Sharif University in Tehran, to various companies in Europe, particularly, but not only in Europe. I think there were some that went to the United States as well, but mainly to European companies seeking various kinds of technologies. And I have to make it clear, it may not have been as clear as it should have been in the article, that we're talking here about hundreds and hundreds of telexes that were intercepted from Sharif University, but it was only a relative handful that really interested the intelligence analysts, particularly those in the United States, but not limited to those, because what they thought they saw there was that these were technologies that would be used in a nuclear program, that is specifically for uranium conversion and uranium enrichment. So what the analysts, as opposed to the people who actually, you know, gathered the telexes, intercepted the telexes, the people who were analyzing them looked these over, picked out these telexes that had to do with certain technologies, and these were specifically fluorine, canisters of fluorine, ring magnets, a balancing machine, and high vacuum equipment, what they call high vacuum equipment. And what the analyst said upon their sucking their thumbs and figuring out what they believe this meant is that the Iranians were potentially interested in a nuclear program here because they were trying to procure a whole series of what is called dual use items that could be used for non-nuclear applications but can also be used for a nuclear program. Now the second thing was the one that really triggered the CIA analyst, the proliferation specialist of the CIA, conclusion that Iran was heading towards a nuclear weapon. And that is that on those telexes from Sharif University, they spotted, not all of them, but on many of them, there was a telex number that coincided with the number of something called the Physics Research Center, which is often called PHRC or often designated as PHRC in the literature. And the Physics Research Center was an outfit that was known to have links to the military and the defense ministry of Iran, had contracts to carry out activities that related to the defense ministry's remit. So they, seeing that, they decided that that meant that the Iranian military was actually using Sharif University as a cover for essentially an Iranian military nuclear program. And that was the theory that underlay a whole series of intelligence judgments from the early 1990s on. And we have a whole series of indications of this, which I cite in my article, beginning with a statement in 1992, a quote from a George H.W. Bush administration official, unnamed, to the Washington Post that said, well, we've been trying to prevent any technology, nuclear technology of any kind, from going to Iran because of, quote, a suspicious procurement pattern. And that, of course, was clearly a reference to the telexes that they'd intercepted and that they had interpreted in a way that indicated to them, at least, that Iran was interested in nuclear weapons. So that was one indication. And then there were leaks to the news media, and in one case, to the producer of a public broadcasting system documentary called Iran and the Bomb that was broadcast in April 1993. And then that producer of the documentary, named Robert Krosny, also published a book in which he characterized these telexes as evidence of clear evidence of an Iranian interest in nuclear weapons. and clearly reflecting what he had been told by various intelligence officials, whether it was German or American officials was unclear, because he clearly went to Germany and did some research there. But in any case, these are indications that that this was had become an official position of the those people in the CIA who were working on proliferation. Now, you know, the biggest, most important indication, though, was in 1996, when the then director of the CIA, John Deutsch, made a public statement in congressional testimony in which he talked about evidence that that Iran had organized both civilian, had tasked both civilian and military organizations to acquire the fissile material for nuclear weapons, for a nuclear weapon. So, I mean, that was the at the top of the CIA, a statement indicating that that was their intelligence conclusion, their intelligence analysis. And then, of course, later on, we have we know that in 2001, the CIA put out the National Intelligence Estimate on Iran, which the Iranian nuclear program, which specifically had a title that indicated that they believed that Iran had a nuclear weapons program. So, I mean, clearly that intelligence estimate, that intelligence assessment, was very much still guiding the position of the CIA and the intelligence community as a whole in regard to Iran's nuclear intentions.
Mm-hmm. All right, and then you talk about in here how the IAEA went back and revisited all this, and they were satisfied by 2007. Is that correct?
Right, and in the meantime, of course, I mean, what happened was that in 2004, as I point out in the story, somebody, presumably either U.S. or Israeli intelligence officials, passed on to the IAEA Safeguard Department, Ali Heinonen. He was deputy director of safeguards in 2004. He became director in 2005. Passed on these, if not the telexes themselves, then intelligence analysis about the intercepted telexes and what they purportedly told the analysts about Iran's nuclear intentions. So the IAEA was tipped off in 2004 that they should investigate the physics research center and demand information from Iran about the role of the PHRC in these requests for procurement. So that became really a centerpiece of the IAEA investigation of Iran for the next 4 years, roughly.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so when we get back, we got to talk about your perfect 2020 hindsight here and how bad of a mistake this was, a real rookie blunder or their good faith best guess or what, and more with the great Gareth Porter, IPSnews.net, top headline today at antiwar.com. About the CIA being wrong about Iran's nuclear program. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I love this song. I'll never get over how much I love this song. All right, that's Dresden 45 for you there. All right, I'm talking with Gareth Porter. And, boy, if you just tuned in, I hope you didn't hear me wrong on the way out to break. We're talking about how the CIA used to be wrong about Iran and thinking that they did have a nuclear weapons program. Of course, we know that they finally got it right starting in 2007 with their national intelligence estimate then that they've reaffirmed year by year ever since, in which the Israeli Mossad officially agrees with now that, no, they don't have a nuclear weapons program and they have not made a political decision to pursue nukes, etc. But so now we're talking about how they got it all screwed up, and what it was a procurement pattern, as they put it, of dual-use technologies at an Iranian university, part of which was tied to the Ministry of Defense there. And so you can see why it would be suspicious
But I guess it sort of sounds like what you're talking about, maybe a problem of methodology where they went, you know, cherry picking all the things that fit and ignored all the things, you know, maybe counted as subterfuge,
that might indicate
other uses for these items over these years, something like
that. That, of course, is exactly what happened, Scott. But behind that mistake, the obvious sort of rookie, if as you put it, rookie intelligence error, is a much more fundamental problem that I discuss at some length in my book. And I don't want to get into detail, but just very briefly, the problem is that the CIA created a new institution in 1991 and early 19, and then sort of reorganized it again in early 1992 that was aimed at raising the profile of the proliferation of WMD.
Oh, that was WinPAC, right?
Pardon?
WinPAC?
No, WinPAC was a successor organization. This was the National Center for Counterproliferation.
Because we know that in 2002 and 3, they were the ones pushing the hardest for the aluminum tube scam
Iraq. Exactly. And that they are closely related to the original organization. But the original organization was 1991-92. And what that did was to focus the attention of the intelligence community far more on the problem of proliferation, which was already identified by publicly by officials of the Bush administration, specifically Robert M. Gates, who had just taken over as the director of the CIA in November 1991, on Iran as a major potential, if not actual, proliferator of nuclear weapons, as well as other kinds of WMD. So what the heads of the intelligence community, and specifically Gates himself, were doing for their own bureaucratic interests in order to have a rationale for maintaining the Cold War levels of spending that had been maintained by the Congress for the CIA and the rest of the intelligence community, was they were creating an expectation that the analysts were going to come up with evidence that Iran was a proliferation threat. And I quote a number of former intelligence officials, some of whom were willing to go on the record, some of whom, one at least, was not willing to be named, but who identified the same problem and talked about how it had been, in his experience, very clearly a problem during the Gulf War, the first Gulf War. I won't go into detail on that, but in any way, it's a well-recognized phenomenon that when you raise expectations on the part of the collectors and the analysts that there's a particular problem that we're looking at and we expect to see some results, they're going to come up with evidence that supports that. And that's exactly what happened in this case. So I think that it all ties in with the larger pattern, the larger picture, if you will, of a national security bureaucracy, a national security state that was gearing up to defend its interests, essentially.
Yeah.
And so
they need an enemy.
They needed an excuse
to continue containing Iran all through the Clinton years rather than having any kind of rapprochement, even under the reign of the so-called moderates, which means friendly faces for Western TV anyway, whatever it means as far as their domestic politics aside. Rafsanjani, Khatami, can't even do business with them. Nuclear, nuclear, nuclear.
That's precisely right. I mean, they needed to have a successor to replace the Soviet threat, and Iran was the single biggest candidate here for all kinds of reasons. And so that's exactly what happened. So then we skip forward, you know, sort of cut to the ending to this story, which is that after 3 years in which the relationship between Iran and the IAEA over their investigation kind of broke down for political reasons, both sides were essentially holding out for their own political reasons, waiting for an ultimate agreement under which the two sides would come together and sort of resolve these issues that had been raised about the Iranian nuclear program. So that was the August 2007 work program. Well, as soon as that agreement was signed, within a matter of months, Iran had turned over to the IAEA this, I would say, an avalanche of documentation on these procurement issues that they had been asked about. And what the evidence showed was that in every case, they were able to show that that it was, in fact, the at the request of faculties of the Sharif University itself that the procurement requests were made. And the reason that you had the telex number of the Physics Research Center on the telexes was that the head of the Physics Research Center, this fellow Shamarati Zavare, was actually a professor at Sharif University, and he had been somebody who had been involved in procurement when he worked in the missile, apparently in the missile program of Iran, and so they relied heavily on him, on his contacts with various companies and his knowledge of the field of technology acquisition, and they asked him to help them make these requests. So he did that, and so he put the Physics Research Center telex number on the request, and that was where the information went when they got back answers from their requests for the technologies. Mm-hmm. So that explains this mysterious telex number, not the fact that the Iranian military was trying to carry out a secret military nuclear program.
Mm-hmm. I think in the article at one point, they're showing the IAEA around saying, yeah, we need to come in here, follow me in this room, and we'll get the paperwork for that so we can answer your question. Oh, yeah, by the way, there's the thingamajig, the whatever piece of technical equipment is still sitting right there on the counter, engaged to the purpose that they claimed in the first place, correct?
The balancing machine that they were so head up about, which they felt was going to be used for the testing of centrifuges, the balancing of centrifuges, mm-hmm. was in fact right there in the the mechanical engineering department, as I remember now.
Okay.
So yes, they did find that equipment there. The magnets, of course, were used by the physics department for what they call lens Faraday experiments, which are apparently just elementary experiments for physics, physics students. Nothing terribly sinister about that at all.
Right.
And so it goes. I mean, you know, all of the information they got was completely credible, irrefutable, showing that these were at the request of the faculty, various faculties of Sharif University, and not having anything to do with the Iranian military. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the IAEA made no effort to suggest that there was anything questionable about any of the documentation that they were given, and they said the issue is closed. The issue of the procurement request is closed. And that was clearly a signal that they had nothing to refute the information they'd gotten from Iran with.
Right. Wow, isn't that something else? It was as simple,
you know,
as they were lying,
Scott,
but no.
Scott, to me, the real sort of a lesson of this whole story in terms of understanding how this system works, I mean, it's not new to your listeners, I know, but it's worth mentioning, and that is that the news media didn't even report the fact that the IAEA report of February 2008, which detailed this entire story of, mm-hmm. of the information that they'd been given, which cleared up the issues the procurement request, this was an extremely important turning point in the investigation, obviously, for the reasons that we've been discussing,
right.
And the news media simply didn't report it.
Well, and you know what? I mean, the thing of it is, there are so few people on the Iran nuclear beat who really know what they're talking about at all, and then subtract away from those who have no motivation whatsoever to make clear the kind of point that you're making clear here, bringing to light the truth where there's misunderstanding, where it's most important, the most important kind of journalism, especially on an issue like this, matters of war and peace, etc. There are very few who are on this beat, who understand the issue well enough, who have the motive to do so, and then among those who you could hold in one hand, including yourself, the rest probably just missed it. You know what I mean? Well, I wouldn't know unless you told me, like just now.
I think it's clear that the journalists who were covering this beat in 2007, 2008 didn't even bother to read the report. They didn't read it.
Well, now, tell me real quickly, you had a little bit of trouble with the media about this story. How's that? Very quickly here.
Yeah, it's true. I can tell you that since this was published, I've had two communications from journalists covering national security for major American publications that questioned me about why is it that I always take the Iranian side in every time that I write about an issue that involves Iran. I always act as though that the Iranian claims are fact. I mean, it was remarkably similar messages that I got within a matter of, overnight. I mean, between last night and this morning. So,
right. And meanwhile, but it's this huge story explaining, undermining the basis of 10 years worth of bad conclusions. They don't have anything to say about that, just about. They don't like how good you are at it. Anyway, I like how good you are at it. Thanks, Gareth. That's Gareth Porter, everybody. Manufactured Crisis is the book. Got to go. See you tomorrow.